Happy Monday and welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. Apparently, I am going to have to watch Ted Lasso right now. And yes, I confess, I have not actually watched it. We're joined by David Frum. I don't know, David, are you a Ted Lasso fan?
I'm always about 6 months behind what everyone else is watching on television. So I'm impressed with myself that I vaguely know that Ted Lasso is a show on TV.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at. So you say you're 6 months behind. I'm way, you know, further behind. I actually like to have, you know, hot new series be in season three before I start, because then I know that my investment is going to be justified. Okay, so let me tell you what I'm looking at right now as we're having this conversation. And we're going to have this deep, serious conversation, right? You know, because we're serious adult people.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
I'm looking at a picture of the former president of the United States wearing a blue suit. You know, I don't know if you've seen this one. Sitting on the back of a Velociraptor. He's got an RPG strapped on his back. He's firing a machine gun, and the Velociraptor is actually carrying a banner with the American flag on it. And the reason I'm looking at this is because this is itself on a flag being held by a sitting member of Congress, Florida Congressman Mike Waltz, who obviously thought that this was a way that maybe he could curry some favor with the former guy. And sure enough, he got the endorsement from Trump. So, in case you haven't seen it, it's not every day you see, you know, a guy shooting a machine gun, riding a Velociraptor with an RPG attached to his back. But apparently this is the price of admission to the House Republican Conference these days, huh?
Well, something I find very strange about this, I'm going to admit I'm kind of a health nut. I run up and down the exercise steps for fun. I do chin-up competitions. I mean, I'm kind of cracked on the subject. And I will talk about it unless headed off. And so I'm just baffled that a person who's obviously the least physically competent president we've had since Franklin Delano Roosevelt post-polio has become this symbol of, I mean, the guy can't lift a glass of water. He can't walk down a ramp. He hasn't done meaningful physical exercise in probably almost half a century. And yet people think he's this rippling
top. He's ripped.
Top. Yeah. He's ripped. And yeah. I mean, you know, I just think if you poked his belly, it wouldn't stop reverberating for half a week. So what are they talking about? Even on their own, crazy terms where manly beauty is the requirement for the president, he's not that. You know, if you want a fit pro, if that's what you care about, the guy you want is Gerald Ford. Now that there was a former male model, you know, a double black diamond skier, played center for the University of Michigan. If that's your idea, if that's your requirement, Ford is your guy. He could handle an RPG on the back of a Velociraptor.
I think there's a word that we're looking for to describe Donald Trump's physique is gelatinous. But yes, it is true that there's a whole genre of Trump porn out there, isn't there? Where he's shown, you know, with his ripped muscles, looking like Rambo, but the Velociraptor is a choice, isn't it? Is that not only does he charge into battle, you know, firing the machine gun with one hand, by the way, and you know, it has the rocket launcher on his back, but that he's riding an extinct dinosaur.
Yeah,
I'm not sure what the message there is. You know,
and let's put it bluntly: the Velociraptor isn't as big as most people think it is. I don't think it could carry him. The guy weighs close to 300 pounds. It would crush the poor Velociraptor to death. So what are we talking about?
Well, so now since we're on the issue of health,
I don't mean to indulge these kinds of things because you can be. You don't have to be physically ripped to be a good president. But
no.
if you're going to claim that as your qualification, walk the walk.
You know, walk the walk. Well, so again congratulations to Congressman Waltz, Mike Waltz, who got the coveted endorsement. The contrast between him and Anthony Gonzalez, I think, is just so striking that you know, Gonzalez is out, but we're going to get more, you know, people with the Velociraptor flag. We're going to have more Marjorie Taylor Greene with a 50 caliber rifle blowing up cars, or we're going to get more, you know, well, crazy stuff, you know.
That's another example of this. So I just finished reading a forthcoming book by Tim Mack about the National Rifle Association. So Tim Mack is a reporter at NPR. He worked for me about a decade ago when I was running a website. And Tim volunteered for the Army Reserve. He qualified as a medic. He's about to get his paratrooper's wings, and he's going for a marksmanship course. He's a real expert on riflery. And one of the things that Tim keeps being baffled by is how none of the gun enthusiasts in Congress seem to have any real idea about how to handle a weapon. That's obviously a plastic toy gun that she's playing with. But if that were, I mean, it's just a model of how, what not to do with, I mean, the weapon is hot to the touch. It makes a lot of noise. It has recoil. And, I mean, it's just, it's like a car. It's, you know, there's more realism in a Marvel comic than there is with these people who are supposed avatars of gun rights.
Well, you remember that immortal moment when Ted Cruz actually cooked some bacon on the barrel of a gun, and then ate. I mean, this is so cartoonish. That's the problem. By the way, did you see Josh Mandel, the leading Republican candidate for Senate's tweet today? This guy is actually running for the United States Senate.
On the message of Shunda for the Goyim, I assume. Which is a Yiddish phrase meaning, you know, the one who shames us before the nations.
Well, he's working at it. He says, here's the tweet, went out this morning. You can't spell pandemic without dem. Is this a coincidence? ? I'm sorry.
Where did you get that book? Jokes from his edition of Jokes for Children?
It's just the jokes from morons. I don't know. So, I guess this is the problem. It's not just that you have a purge of people, you know, and apparently Trump wants to purge Mitch McConnell. It's that as a result of it, you're getting more of this. You're getting this dumb shit. You're getting the bigoted stuff. You're getting the, you know, the Madison Cawthorns. You're getting J.D. Vance saying that Nicki Minaj is more reputable than Rachel Maddow. You're getting Trump writing letters in Georgia's, you know, asking them to decertify the election and declare him the real winner. I mean, it's just, I'm sorry, David. People who say, you guys should take this more seriously, if you don't laugh at it, if you don't understand how ludicrous it is, it will make you crazy. It will be like you've taken crazy pills.
Yeah. Well, the thing that is really, this is maybe a segue to something else you want to talk about. So the Biden administration is making a series of very profound choices, not just about taxing and spending and emergency relief, but about the structure of the economy. They're coming up with a much more activist approach to antitrust. I'm working actually right now, my next story for The Atlantic is about what they're doing in the ag business. And many of these choices are hugely important and hugely consequential and hugely debatable. So there is no one in the Republican Party who is saying this reactivation of antitrust policy that the Biden people have in mind, is this a good idea? I know the Biden people are conflicted about it. There are smart arguments on the other side. When they come down, as I think they will, on the more activist approach, somebody needs to be speaking for the less active approach. And we need, given that we are condemned to be a two-party system, we need the other party to stand up and actually oppose the administration party on important things that affect people's lives in a meaningful way. And every time you're talking about these culture war hot buttons, you know who really can relax are the people inside the Biden administration who are pushing policies that otherwise would have been opposed on policy grounds.
Yeah, I mean, and there are legitimate arguments to make about antitrust. That's the size of spending packages. Their push to beef up the IRS by giving them access to every bank account that has more than $600 in it. I mean, there are some meaty issues that I think would touch people's lives, and that have long term consequences. But instead, what we're talking about, you know, whatever it is that Madison Cawthorn Paul Gosar want to talk about any given day. And of course, you know, Kevin McCarthy is a man, you know, without principles or a plan beyond just getting the majority.
Right. And I think there are Republicans who think, let me just do this stuff and then I'll get into Congress and then I'll be responsible.
Right.
I think that's J.D. Vance's plan, obviously.
Yeah.
I do intend someday to be a senator who will bring credit to the state of Ohio, but first I have to go through this absurd fraternity hazing. But what everyone is about to discover is the way you campaign does affect the way you govern. You actually eliminate options. You introduce yourself to a certain set of person. You gain or lose trust in certain ways. And so, and the anti-vax thing has been consequential because the Republicans, they thought they could just use the issue without being consumed by the issue.
Right.
But in fact, it's given them an identity that it's the idea, I'm not anti-vax, I'm anti-vax mandate, is too complicated. That people want to know pro for it or against it. Well, I'm for it. I just respect the people who won't do it so much that I think they should be allowed to infect others. So that sounds like you're for it. That sounds like, sorry, you're against the vax. And you need in politics oftentimes very simple, clear messages. Once you govern, you can start filling in all the detail. But you need to plant your flag somewhere. And there's been a lot of opportunistic planting the flag in ground Republicans, most Republicans don't want to hold, but where they find, wait a minute, I can't get this flag now out of the ground, having right. put it in the ground.
Well, let's talk about the vaccine mandates. And I know that you've been writing a lot about this lately. A couple of things. It does seem that there are polls out showing that vaccine hesitancy is a lot more widespread than we would like to think. But also, as these mandates are put into effect, what we're finding is the compliance is pretty high, and yeah. that the number of people who, you know, are saying, well, I will resign if I have to get the vaccine, actually those numbers are very low, aren't they? So they work.
I've been doing a thread keeping track of this. I mean, mm-hmm. if you here's a classic problem in the history of polling. If you ask people, did you vote in the last election?
Right.
You will come up with a number about 20 points higher than the number of people who actually did vote in the last election. That it's easy to say things in a poll. And people are, they don't actually do all that they say. So when you ask a question like, would you refuse the vax? It's cost-free to say, you know, and once you've got that in your head, it's a sign of identity and loyalty. Yeah, that's a cheap answer. Now you say, no, this is going to cost you something. You may not be able to go to the bar you want. You may not be able to go to a football competition. You may lose your job. Then people, well, wait a moment. Now that I have to weigh the costs and benefits, I arrive at a different answer. And so we're seeing a big difference. And I've been doing this. This annoys some of the anti-vaxxers, but they got very excited that in the University of Indiana healthcare system, something like 125 people lost their jobs in the middle of September over not being vaccinated. So see, there's massive resistance. But you look, the university system has 34,000 staff, more than that, 34,000 staff. When they had a September 1st deadline, you must be vaccinated. It's a hospital system. You must be vaccinated to work in the hospital system. Yeah. And 300 people were suspended out of 34,000 for missing the deadline. And then they gave them 2 weeks and said, okay, you're suspended without, if you can get your job back if by 9/14, by September 14th, you're vaccinated. And then of the 300 holdouts, all but 125 were vaccinated. And those 125 were part-timers. So it's 61 full-time equivalents out of 34,000. Mm. And you think, you know what? Those 61 full-time, those 120, they shouldn't be working in a hospital.
No.
I mean, that's good for the patients. If people,
absolutely.
Because are they washing their hands? Are they, you know, wearing a hairnet? I mean, if you are that indifferent to the health of the people you're working with, you shouldn't be in a hospital.
That's a great point. No, that's a great point. It's like if you are reckless on this point, what else are you not doing? And I think I keep coming back to that question. Anyone who thinks that you somehow have an entitlement or a right to work in healthcare with vulnerable people who are by definition perhaps you know much more likely to be immunocompromised without being vaccinated, it's a crazy idea. So talk to me a little bit about you got into a back and forth with one of our former colleagues, Andrew Egger, who's now over at the Dispatch, who suggested it would be deeply unfair to extend the vaccine mandate to people who are naturally immune, which would include people who've already had the coronavirus and in theory have some sort of antibodies. And you were just not having it. You were not buying it.
Well, anyway, I see afterwards that Andy took this personally and got upset about it, and I'm really sorry about that because it wasn't meant personally. And he then complained on Twitter that he'd written this article for the Dispatch, and he posted a link to it, and I wrote a tweet that said the word no five times and gave five reasons for saying no. And what I did was I took issue with his conclusion. I didn't visit his reasoning. And so he got annoyed with me that I had not respectfully worked through his reasoning for reaching the answer. But I thought that I would have been too personal and anyway, not interesting. The point is the answer. Should we carve out an exemption to vaccine requirements for people who have had COVID before? And there are five reasons why the answer to that is no. And I'm sorry that he felt roughly handled, and I apologize. I didn't mean to make it personal. I didn't mean to. What? He just happened to. People are making this argument. He happened to make it more clearly and more visibly than others. So I jumped off from then, but it was not a comment about him. It was a comment about the answer. But here are the reasons why this. First, we don't know exactly. How much COVID exposure buys you how much. So there's, it's not like something where this is not like one of those diseases you get it once and you never get it again. Like smallpox, if it doesn't kill you, it may leave your face disfigured, but at least you know you're never going to have smallpox again. People get COVID more than once. It's unusual, but they do. But when you're looking for, I'm thinking about these things like a lawyer. When you're looking for a rule that is clear, simple, easy to enforce, do you have the QR code that shows you took the vax? Come on into our bar. Do you not? Don't. And everything else is complicated. And if there's a suggestion, well, you could get a doctor's note that says you've had the disease before, and therefore that's as good. Sorry, this is the land of Dr. Oz. This is a country full of Dr. Quacks. I can't trust I don't know who this doctor you have from a state 300 miles away, whether this is a reputable doctor, or whether it's an osteopath, or whether it's a homeopathic doctor. I don't know. I don't know that it's a real doctor. Well, then the answer is maybe you show the underlying blood work. Well, that's way more invasive. But the final point is there. Embedded, and this is my ultimate complaint, embedded in this argument about so-called natural immunity is that the vaccination is some kind of imposition or inconvenience. It's a bad thing that people, that a rational person would reasonably want to avoid if they could. And that is, right now, where we are, this country needs that idea smacked down so hard. It is not, I mean, I just had, I'm going to Sub-Saharan Africa for the first time. And next month. And as part of that, I'm holding in my hand my passport and beside it the papers that are the vaccination part of my vaccination passport, which is what you had showing the list of vaccinations I've had, including yellow fever. And when you get them, some of them are kind of yellow fever shot is kind of uncomfortable. If you didn't go to West Africa, you wouldn't get the yellow fever shot because it is authentically uncomfortable. But it's better than getting yellow fever, which can kill you. So I got it, and had an uncomfortable couple of hours, and then I got over it. If you want to go to West Africa, it's a miracle of science. It's not an imposition, and the COVID vaccination is even less burdensome. I know some people have a bad day. I personally did not. Most of the people I know did not, but some people do. But compared to the alternative, it's a blessing. It's a miracle. And we got it less than 14 months after the disease was identified. We should be grateful and we should stop indulging the idea that a reasonable person would rationally want to avoid it.
And just this morning, we got the word that there's new Pfizer research out showing that low doses are safe for children 5 to 11, which suggests to me that we are very, very close to having a vaccine that will get all of our kids back to school. This is a huge thing if we're willing to follow that medical research.
Don't we want this over?
Yes.
Desperately. don't we want to just put this all, get this over? And an extraordinary work by a lot of talented people has made it possible to see the day when this is all over. And that day could be, it should have been this fall. It could be next spring. Let's just get it over with and then go on to, one of the things that happened in 2020 was in 2018 and 2019, America made good progress against the opioid epidemic. Opioid deaths came down. In 2020, they spiked up again. And you can sort of guess why. People were out of work. They were at home. They were alone. They were frustrated. So anyone who had any kind of dependency on these kinds of drugs had an opportunity to revert. And then there were these stimulus bills that put a lot of money in people's hands. So they had the wherewithal with which to purchase the pills and the flare up of the things that made them dependent on them. And so the result was the 2020, we saw a spike in COVID, in opioid deaths. We're talking right now about the COVID problem, which is absolutely easy to solve, we have the wherewithal to solve it. Once we do that, we can get back to a truly difficult national health crisis, which we don't have good answers to, and that is opioids, which are killing people on a large scale. And we are stealing the time away from them. We are stealing the time away from our obesity. You know, people keep saying, as if it's a debater's point, that obesity makes you more vulnerable to COVID. Why don't we do something about obesity? Okay, I'm with you. Let's do something. And I mean, people might not like, I'm sympathetic to some of the more Bloombergian interventions. You don't have to agree with me, maybe it's other things. Mm-hmm. But we're not actually going to do anything about it until we get this first problem out of the way. So let's solve the problems that are solvable and then create mental space and budget and emotional time to go to work on the things that are really hard.
And I think that there's some polls out suggesting that I think that despite what you see on Fox News or Twitter, that most people are kind of there, that they're willing to do it, that if they think that if they have to wear masks and, you know, get vaccinated, if it will get us through this, it is worth it. Okay, let's switch gears a little bit here, because I really wanted to talk to you about a piece you wrote in The Atlantic last week. What the Never Trumpers Want Now. The cultural core of the GOP is exiting the party. The Democrats should keep those voters in their corner. Here's how to do it. So I want to break down your piece, David, you can descend on this, into two parts. The first is, will you explain why Republicans left the party, why people were disillusioned, and that experience, which I found to be one of the best descriptions of the process of disillusionment, and then get to what, you know, where do they go now? Did the Democrats rent them? Did they buy them? So do you want to break it down into two like that? Or is it breaking down? You want to break it down into three or four? Because I thought your description of what it was like to be a Republican who believes certain things and then watch those values be thrown apart and then look around and go, who are you people? Why do I, what should I trust? So talk to me about that a little bit. The process of disillusion.
We've all been through this. It's deeply wrenching. I mean, you don't want to exaggerate. This is a free country, and look, some people like you have taken real economic hits along the way, but you're not, even at the worst moments for you, you were never in danger of going to prison or having your house taken away from you or the kinds of things that happen. And, you know, you had a shock to your income. You had a shock to your ways of working. And that was painful enough. But the real impact, and I certainly in my case, and I think even you would say this, it was to our peer group, our friendship, our sense of ourselves and our sense of others. And these associations are tremendously important emotionally, but also I think it's how we build our world. And you know, we always have friends. We think, okay, this friend's a little out there, but their heart's in the right place. And they sometimes say a wacky thing or two, but you know, you change the subject to, you know, the fly fishing or whatever it is. And it's normal. So we've gone through this of being discovering that things that you find profoundly unacceptable, other people whom you know and trusted and cared about, they find them acceptable. And they then, by the way, also look at you and say, I thought you were loyal to me. And I thought when we all agreed that we were going to do this thing, even if we would all do it together, why aren't you with us? And why are you being critical? Why are you judging me in this way? So it's like a kind of emotional exile. You find yourself estranged. And once you do that, I quoted something Christopher Hitchens said to me many years ago when I was asking about leaving socialism. And he said he felt like a man tumbling down a hill. And every time he clutched at a branch to break his fall, the branch snapped in his hand. And then he found himself, you know, with at the end of the process. And, you know, and he said, I miss socialism the way a man might miss an amputated arm, but there's no going back to it.
That spoke to me is the UK. Well, I can still have this, right? Okay, well, I can still believe this, or maybe this is salvageable. And one after another, you're disabused of that, and so you keep falling and find yourself suddenly in this kind of no man's land.
Now, people will say, who cares about Charlie Sykes? Who cares about David Frum? You're just, you know, and at some deep level, of course, that's true. Who cares about any one of us? But it's also true that through the history of the American party system, it sort of politically involved people are harbingers of what others will do. And this is something I cut from the article because it was a little, it was, you know, too much detail, but I'll say it on the air. So whenever we've had big changes in the party system, you can see individuals who sort of lead the way. I set the example of Lyman Trumbull, who was a senator from Indiana during the Civil War, a close associate of Abraham Lincoln's, and the drafter of the 13th Amendment and the principal force in getting the 13th Amendment through the Senate. Lyman Trumbull started his life as a Jacksonian Democrat, and in the crisis of the 1850s found himself forced out of his party into this new Republican Party. And it was often very uncomfortable for him. And he was never kind of an easy Republican. And but that's where he stayed. Or Harold Ickes, who ran the Public Works Program. He was Secretary of the Interior under Franklin Roosevelt. He was a Democrat who had started life as a Teddy Roosevelt Republican and worked on Teddy Roosevelt's campaigns and then followed Teddy Roosevelt into the Bull Moose Party and ended up a Democrat. And we knew so many people like Paul Nitze and Eugene Rostow had started off in their career as Truman Johnson Democrats and ended up in the Reagan world. And you might say, well, who's Paul Nitze? Who cares about Paul Nitze? But what Paul Nitze went through in a articulate, conscious way, he spent a lot of time thinking about it, millions of other people who are less close to the political system were having some similar kind of experience. So it's always people who think a lot about politics are always aberrational by definition.
Right.
But what we are working through in our full-time thinking, we're not doing it alone. We're doing it as part of a larger social movement in which other people who are, you know, more psychologically normal and spend less time thinking about it, but they're going through a similar kind of transition. We can just explain what it's like because we think about it more fully.
So how, you know, I mean, the long-term joke has been that Never Trump is not a movement, it's a dinner party. You know, what you just explained, though, is why it does have impact on elections. How significant was that group in the 2020 election? How important is it for Democrats to pay attention to the argument you're making that, hey, you might want to keep these people around?
It was much more important in 2018 than in 2020, and it will be more important in 2022 than in 2020. Look, when you have the drama of a presidential election, you can really get a lot of juice by revving up the core part of your party. And even for the Democrats, who they're just a much more mixed, they're a bigger coalition, but they've got many more moving parts than the Republican Party, and Democrats are more different one from another than Republicans are one from another. But in with the excitement of a presidential election, you can focus it on, so anti-Donald Trump could unite a lot of different people. But in 2018, Democrats won the House by winning, I keep pointing to this, they won George H.W. Bush's former seat in Houston. This is a seat that Bush won in 1966, and that stayed Republican through Watergate, through the 9/11, through the Iraq War, through the 2008 financial crisis, stayed Republican even through the election of Donald Trump in 2016. The Democrats took it in 2018. Newt Gingrich's former seat near Atlanta, that Gingrich took that in 78, and it stayed Republican again from 78 until 2018. Eric Cantor's former seat in the affluent suburbs of Richmond, Virginia. That had been Republican since the early 80s and went Democratic in 2018. Barbara Comstock's seat on the south shore of the Potomac River, that's been Republican for 60 of the past 66 years. And it went Democratic in 2018. Now, those seats were not won by Bernie Bros. They were not won by activating the urban progressive base of the Democratic Party, and they were not won by minority voters either. They were won because a lot of people who are culturally, had been culturally Republican, had voted Republican for Romney and McCain and George W. Bush, and especially the women, said, I can't abide Trump. And the Democrats have convinced me they're a safe vote. They will not do anything too much that I don't like. I can trust them enough that I can solve this problem. And if those Republicans did better down the ballot in 2020 than they did at the top, and so Democrats who are looking at the 2022 election need to understand, the districts I just mentioned, those are the districts they need to worry about. and those districts are not going to respond to a turnout the base message.
So what do Democrats need to do? Because this is a point, by the way, that I've tried to make over and over again, that you know, it's the control of the Congress is not going to be determined by the, you know, 20, you know, plus 20 Democratic districts or the plus 20 Republican districts. They're going to be determined by, you know, the seats held by the Abigail Spanbergers of the world right now. Mm-hmm. And I wonder whether or not that thinking or that understanding dominates a lot of the debate that we're seeing right now. Your take?
Well, sometimes it helps to visualize the individual people you're trying to reach, because you can talk about these things abstractly, we can talk in percentages. But, you know, when an Abigail Spanberger knocks on the door and deals with the people who voted for her in 2018, made her election a little tenser in 2020, and who will decide in 2022 whether she keeps her job and whether the Democrats keep that seat, who's she talking to?
Okay.
Well, she's talking more to women than to men. Women who've been to college, women who are probably married and probably have children, who are a little more economically secure than most, and a little more culturally, little more culturally moderate, a little more responsive to a message of moderation and consideration. I mean, one of the things that Democrats will often ask is, well, the Republicans do all these outrageous things. We should be just as outrageous.
Yeah.
Those outrageous things absolutely activate the deep rural Republicans who feel culturally isolated. But the people whom Abigail Spanberger is meeting at the door, who voted for her in 2018 and went a little wobbly in 2020 and will decide her fate in 2022, they do not like a rough message. They want a gentle message. They want to feel pride in the way they voted. One of the things that Donald Trump consistently got wrong was he never understood that, and the people around him never understood that, a lot of people just thought he was not a fit person to have these enormous responsibilities. He just didn't behave in the right way and talk in the right way. He was a nasty piece of work. And they didn't like, there are people who found that exciting, but more people found it repulsive. And if you are tempted to say, well, why can't we be like that? You have to bear in mind, it's not just wrong to do, it's also unwise to do. That doesn't mean that every issue has to be split down the road. There are a lot of issues where, look, we Republicans are going to pay a policy price for Trump. Our taxes will be higher than they otherwise, you know. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's just, there are going to be some things that are going to happen in the 2020s that I wish would not happen. But I accept those things as the price of first beating Trump and then secondly, purging these toxins in the American political system. And the Republicans need to lose some elections, you know, to my ideological and in some cases personal financial cost, in order to get us to a world where we can have a stronger, more functioning political system.
So let me read you your conclusion of this piece, because it goes to the question of, you know, where do these voters go, and, you know, how permanent is the shift? You write, a person who votes even once to protest against cruelty and in favor of empathy will be changed enduringly by that single action. We often act first and then develop the explanations for our actions later. And those new explanations may force us to reconsider previous prejudices, which is very true. I mean, we've just been discussing that. That's process. The pro-Trump Republicans and conservatives got one thing right about their anti-Trump former comrades. Never Trump was not fundamentally a political movement. It was a moral reflex. Will that reflex now be integrated into normal politics in the post-Trump era? If it can, it will transform American politics and very possibly save the country from the forces of polarization, extremism, bigotry, and authoritarianism. Mm-hmm. I agree with that completely. That is the moral reflex. Do Democrats fully understand that, though?
Let me put it this way. The highly online don't, because they don't think about politics in that way. I mean, they are very committed. All of us who are highly online, and I include mm-hmm. myself, I mean, we've got elaborately worked out political theories.
Yeah.
And so we're less responsive to that, to the, he just doesn't seem like a very nice person message. Yeah. But lots of people do respond to it. And I think there are lots of people who are highly online who also are happy to go over the cliff, all flags flying, who want to win the argument rather than win the election, who are interested in sort of political micro-targeting. I think also the attacking that a lot of the attitude that the highly online, more activist Democrat has toward Never Trump is a way of having a proxy war against the mainstream of the Democratic Party. Right now, it's if you are highly online urban progressive Democrat, you don't want to go attacking James Clyburn. That's going to get you some blowback. So, but when the points you're making against the Never Trump Republicans are also points in an internal argument against the James Clyburns of this world.
Because they're afraid that the Never Trumpers' influence will be to moderate the party, so they become the stand-in for attacking establishment centrist Democrats.
Exactly. And the other thing, the thing that the centrist Democrats understand very well is the Democratic Party is like, it's sort of like Los Angeles. It's a metropolis made up of all of these villages, and the villages are very different from one another, and they're not very well connected. So the idea that a Democratic Party could ever have a clear, consistent, bold ideological message, it's just too diffuse a party. It doesn't work that way. The Republicans can do it that way because the Republican Party is smaller and more homogeneous, but the Democratic Party really can't. And so the key to success for Democrats has always been being a little bit blurry and including a lot of people who might not normally get along. And if what you want is an ideological progressive party, you have to fight the political professionals in the Democratic Party, say that's not going to work for us. It might work for them. It's not going to work for us.
So you describe the mentality of the people who have been disillusioned by the Republican Party as the moral reflex, looking around saying that, you know, our former allies, our former orthodoxies just don't work. And if I can't trust you on this, why should I trust you on that? So I have to rethink a lot of things. But I get a sense that many of them are also then looking at the political landscape right now and saying, okay, we've put, you know, Trumpism and maybe even Republicanism behind us, but we didn't sign up for what the Democratic Party is. I mean, that's also part of it. And so the question is, who defines what the Democratic Party is? You know, if you turn on cable news, you look at the, much of, online political discourse, you think the Democratic Party is AOC, when, as we've been discussing, no, it's much more complex than that. I mean, that's kind of a challenge, isn't it? You know, what is the appeal? Because if it is, and some people may not like this, but if it is AOC, if it is Bernie, then a lot of those folks who, as a moral reflex, abandon the Republican Party are going to look at the Democrats and say, I don't want to be part of that either. And I'm not going to stay there. I'm not going to go with you during the midterms, particularly if Donald Trump is not on the ballot. And maybe I might vote to put a check on that if I think that that's where you're going.
That's right. I think that is certainly right. And it means that one of the reasons that the Democrats would normally have a bad year in 2022 is the American public has a kind of reflex that just they automatically do that. But the thing that the Republicans are doing that is the biggest advantage Democrats have is the only thing in this country that is maybe even more unpopular than Donald Trump is COVID. And Republicans had their historic strength in the suburbs, in the areas where people have a little bit more security, a little bit more education than some of their neighbors. And so when you say our issue in 2022 is going to be no to the effective measures that put COVID behind us, that may well work in the more culturally alienated parts of America, but it's not going to work in the suburbs of Northern Virginia. It's not going to work in the in Eric Cantor's district. It's not going to work in Newt Gingrich's district. It's not going to work in what was George H.W. Bush's district. They're going to say, these people, don't want to check that people have been vaccinated. That's nuts. So they do have the Republican self-destruction against them. But I would say for the Democrats, the really important thing is not to talk more radically than you intend to govern. And there is a tendency of the Democratic Party to say, we'll give the words to the left and the deeds to the right of our party. And they might actually do better to do it the other way around, to try to govern a little bit more to the left and talk a lot more to the right.
Yeah, it does strike me that defund the police was such an obvious loser for Democrats. But right now they have a real opening since so many Republicans are willing to associate themselves with people who beat cops up. It will be interesting to see whether or not they could flip the script on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And by the way, you know, you might try different. Vaccinate the police.
Yeah.
Because if you dislike the police, one of the things you notice is that the police unions have been some of the most ardent opponents of vaccination. And it's a good guess that the police who are most individually resistant to vaccination are the people who probably least belong on a police force. So,
yeah.
So you can speak to the suburbs who like vaccination and also feed your anti-police base in that way. But I think the main thing, and this is where the Democrats pay a little bit of a price for Biden's age. You know, I don't think Biden is mentally diminished at all or in any important way. He may have trouble remembering a name or two, but he's clearly physically diminished. Mm-hmm. And he's just not a physically energetic president. And so what you – knowing that this president in particular is a much more – is the most reassuring face in his party, you would think you'd want him out there all the time.
Yeah.
And because of his age, they can't do that. And that is a real problem they're going to have in 2022.
Okay, so in the time we have left, I wanted to switch topics again because I know you've written very, very extensively about Afghanistan and for the final days of the Trump administration. I wanted to get your take on what we're learning about the Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, making a call to the Chinese, reassuring them that no, Donald Trump wasn't going to be launching a nuclear attack, and getting all the generals together and saying, you know, this is the chain of command. There was this massive blowback when this was first reported that somehow General Milley had gone rogue. But the more we find out about it, the less roguish he seems.
Well, this is part of the, I think, generally pernicious influence that Bob Woodward has on the media ecosystem. So Woodward produces these books, which are, and especially since the departure of Alice Mayhew from Simon & Schuster, who was the editor who used to turn his notes into a finished manuscript, the books are sort of slapped together without a lot of regard for context. In a way, I mean, it isn't that they're inaccurate, although there are things in them that are always inaccurate. Like I think the end of his Casey book where he claims to have former CIA director Bill Casey's words, that pretty clearly looks to be untrue and made up. And
it's kind of a big thing.
Yeah, there's the famous story about the flower pot in his window with deep throat. That's obviously made up. But most of the time, the things are accurate as literally printed, but they're in contexts that are distorted and misleading. So then you take, and the books have become increasingly, since, again, Alice Mayhew has been out of the picture, the books have become increasingly slapdash. Then they are released. Then excerpts from them are released a week before the book itself. And not only are excerpts released, but publishers' summaries are released in a way to catch attention. And so what happened with the Milley thing is you took something that was a story about Milley working with other people in the defense establishment, including the Secretary of Defense, through the chain of command to reassure foreign counterparts of the stability of American policy. It's not even clear that President Trump didn't know about this, or if he didn't, or then president. And if he didn't know, we don't know that it was that he wasn't told, or that, well, we put it in his briefing book.
Yeah.
If he didn't know, that's not on us. Wait a minute. That's a dirty trick. You put it in a briefing book and you expected him to know it?
Yeah.
Why didn't you call into Fox and Friends if you wanted him to know? You put it in a book? But it's not clear that President Trump was uninformed. He might have been ignorant of it, but it was not clear that he was uninformed of it. And so then you put it in the Woodward book in a way that torques it. And then you put it in the news stories in a way that torques it more. And then it goes on to social media and you get these reactions. And they lead heroes of the Republic like Alexander Vindman to say things that – because, I mean, Vindman's a career military man. He's never – try to work his way through line by line a Woodward book to say, how did he put this together, and discover, well, there's a lot of bailing, a lot of sticking tape here, safety pins. This is not how I'd put together a book. That's not his job. People believe it. And they're told again and again that Bob Woodward is the gold standard of American reporting. So often he's delivering fool's gold.
And I am so glad you're doing this, because this is so important. I thought it was just me when I read the last Woodward book, and I thought, you know, how shallow it was, how sort of it sort of jumps around, you know, disconnected facts, sort of misses the larger picture, misses the, you know, the real gravamonte of what he was writing about. And yet, because he's Woodward, there is that certain, you know, there's that... There's a certain, you know, piety about all of it, but his stuff has been somewhat slapdash. It is questionable. There have been reporters who have re-reported some things that he's written that raise really serious questions. And then the process that you describe of how, you know, it's like a game of telephone where, you know, excerpts are put out and then social media gets out. And then, you know, by the end of the phone call, you have the completely wrong end of the story. And I think that's what happened here. And I think this is a cautionary tale for journalism and people who comment on this sort of thing.
Well, as everyone who's had to report a story knows, it's not just enough to quote what people say.
Right.
Because first, people don't always tell the truth. Mm-hmm. Second, even if they mean to tell the truth, they don't always remember it exactly. Third, they always remember in a way that flatters themselves. And finally, it's just a bias of human. You can't pretend, you're not a camera. You are a human being too. And you have a duty to the reader, which is to say, I need to put this into a way where this is what I think happened and I take responsibility. And I might be wrong, but I'm taking responsibility for it. So I'm not presenting this as just a transcript of what happened in the room, because... Well, transcripts are also misleading unless you see everything. So what you get are these situations where you're left with a false – it's even if it's a case where there's nothing that is literally untrue. Like the end of one of the last of the Trump books, he quotes Donald Trump's lawyer, I think it's John Doerr. The final line is, and the problem is the president is a fucking liar.
Right.
And –
That's
the last line. That's a big thing. And it's supposed to make you think that Doerr, man of integrity, has realized with disgust that this person who's been lying to him for 2 years, he's just figured it out and has turned his back in shame and indignation. But Doerr was talking about why Doerr's particular strategy of deception. Doerr's own unethical strategy wasn't going to work because it relied on Donald Trump being more disciplined, but Donald Trump couldn't be more disciplined, and therefore Doerr's unethical actions fell apart. But because Doerr talked to Woodward and was so that Woodward then gives him a shoeshine and makes him a much more high toned person than Doerr really was, and that problem just besets these books.
Well, and there is a lot of shoe shining that goes on in these books. You can see that there are people who are burnishing their own reputations, or, you know, posing in a way that he seems to sometimes uncritically accept. I think the best reporters of the Trump era are the ones who realize that you have to triangulate everything you hear. Just assume that everybody's got an agenda, you know, that two-thirds of the people, three-quarters of the people are lying, and that you have to, you know, have a much different point of view. And I'm not sure that Woodward, despite all of his you know, experience, really fully grasps that. I know that seems harsh for me to say. You know,
it's not harsh enough, frankly, because Woodward's method is always transactional. You give me access, I'll give you a shoeshine. And the Alan Greenspan book is the outstanding example of this. Alan Greenspan, you know, is this hero, and so Woodward's method with Trump was Woodward was there at the very beginning, negotiating for access in the Trump administration, in the inauguration period. And I've written two articles about this method, one in 2018 and one in 2020 for The Atlantic. And I recommend, the details are there. But he would go on TV and defend Trump against stories of Russian influence and attack reporters who had done real cutting edge work, because he knew that especially bothered Donald Trump, and use his attacks on other reporters' work and use the enormous prestige he has from 50 years ago to undermine them and use that to get the access for his own purpose. So he was not giving you a disinterested he was not giving you, this is, you know, my magisterial position, evaluation of this. I am paying the toll to get the access I need for the book I want to do. And then through that book, in the second of the Trump books, he gives a huge good time to Mohammed bin Salman, the you know, the murderous crown prince of Saudi Arabia, because the person who gave him access at that point in the National Security Council was a big promoter of MBS. And so he paid for his access by giving a good time to the Saudi prince. And unfortunately, the book is published. It's written before the murder of Khashoggi, published after. And because Woodward never revises,
it's there.
It's still there.
No, you have to actually like make a list of like who are the sources, who are the insiders, whose perspective is being pushed here, and because otherwise you will be misled. David Frum, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you so much. Bye bye.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.